If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Paul Listnick, Behind the Curtain, my opportunity to step away from the world of politics and law that you watch me cover on television every day into the world of theater and the arts. But you know, this particular show doesn't step all that far away, if indeed at all, from the world of politics and law, because the show we're going to talk about clearly envelops those issues in a very powerful way. And as Timeline Theater, who is the sponsor of this show, one of the sponsors of the show, creators of the show, for the audiences here, you're going to see this is a history being repeated for everybody. You're going to love this. Anyway, let me introduce you to all those involved in a show called Debate Baldwin versus Buckley. It's playing, well, the Timeline Theater's itinerant this year, so it's playing at DePaul University over at the Cordell U Commons on Fremont. I'll give you that information again in a little bit. And I sort of stumbled, as I said, Timeline, because they're doing this in conjunction with DePaul University, but it's actually even a little bit bigger than that, which we'll understand. Let me introduce you to the stars and the adapter and director of the show. We start with, well, since it's called Baldwin versus Buckley, we'll start with Baldwin. And Tegel Bouger, who plays James Baldwin, who was an American author, orator, civil rights activist. Yes, this was a real thing. These are real people. They lived on our earth. Tegel himself has been seen a lot at Court Theater. And you need to do more work on Broadway, Tegel, because all you've done is The Tempest with Patrick Stewart, Raised in the Sun with Felicia Rashad, Last Dance for Sybil with Ruby Dee. Don't you one day want to perform with like a big name?
Yes.
What amazing. I mean, just the stories you must have to tell. In fact, let's tell those stories. And also joining us, playing probably the tougher part of Buckley. And I say that because of the place that you're performing this in terms of audience response and receptiveness. But you knew that getting into it. Eric T. Miller plays William F. Buckley Jr. I remember him. He was on TV an awful lot as a kid, a conservative intellectual and founding editor of the National Review, which is still around today. Eric, this is your Timeline debut, so that's cool. I mean, finding a home in time. Although I do have to ask you, as I look through your work, you were part of a show called Couriers and Contrabands, which was with Timeline Projects. Was that totally separate? Had nothing to do with Timeline?
Yeah, totally separate. New York company. Wonderful show about some Civil War activists. But no affiliation.
Gotcha. Okay. Now we got that cleared up. And you worked in Hope at Ensemble Theater, Awake and Sing at Huntington. Lots of great stuff for you. You and I do share one role together. I also have played Lieutenant Trank in West Side Story. You did it in Syracuse. I did it in high school in Skokie. But I'm willing to take you on if you want to kind of compare those.
Bring it, Paul.
Performances. And Christopher McElrone, the adapter, the director of this show, the founding artistic director of the American Vicarious, co-founded the Classical Theater of Harlem, where you've overseen 41 productions and no awards, sadly. Only 18 Adelco Awards, 6 Obies, 2 Lucille Lortel Awards, a Drama Desk. As you can see, there's always a little sarcasm when I say things, because it means you're incredibly accomplished, as you all are. And I guess I feel so unaccomplished, I just have to talk about what you guys have done. Christopher, I want to start with you, because y'all have been working on this. Is not something that got developed in the last few months to present a Timeline or with Timeline. This has years of history behind it. So for our viewers and listeners, we have both here. For our viewers and listeners, let them know how this project started.
Yeah, we picked it up in the summer of 2020, following the murder of George Floyd and the run-up to the presidential election, Trump and Biden. And it felt important in that moment to participate to the conversation that was happening in America about race, about our civil discourse, or the lack of civility in our discourse. And this was the perfect vehicle, because we could not have in-person audiences. And so the first time we did it, we did 3 live television broadcasts of the work, which allowed us to contribute to the conversation in a way that still was respecting the pandemic guidelines that were in place.
Can I ask, because I know this is a project that is going through the United States, but also the UK. And I know we're going to get about the event itself, but you've actually have performed this in the actual location where the real event took place. So, but the television, was that UK or was that here?
No, that was here in Brooklyn, BRIC, which is an organization in downtown Brooklyn. And so it's a theater space, but they also have a television network. And so we gathered on 3 consecutive days and did 3 live broadcasts, which felt important in that moment to still gather and say these words.
And let me just add in one other thing. This was real. Part of the show is showing us some footage. We see the actual Baldwin and Buckley up on the screen and others. And so I'm going to come to our actors in just a moment. But as far as that goes, what was it about? How did you find this? And as I understand it, this almost didn't get into the public domain. This almost was something. I mean, didn't Baldwin and Buckley fight this transcript being available out there?
So I had known about the material for a very long time, and again, the summer of 2020 seemed to be the right time to pick it up. But to your point, one of the things that both Baldwin and Buckley agreed on coming out of the debate was their intellectual property, and they both sued the New York Times to protect that intellectual property because the New York Times published the complete transcript of the debate. They did lose that. I think they each got like $500 or something like that. I don't remember the exact history, but yeah, so it falls in the public domain because it was covered as a news event, from Jump.
Yeah, and that you incorporate that is amazing. You're back in New York now?
I am.
Do
Yes.
you need me to be you on a nightly basis?
Hey, go for it. So, I mean, you've got the voice for it, Paul.
You know, when it happened, when I saw it, now our viewers in Washington go, what is he talking about? If they haven't seen the show, go see the show and you'll see what I'm talking about. But when that happened, there is a moment of, wait, is this real? Is this, and I know that's what you want, right? What's going on here and stuff. So, yeah, you might need me to step in. And plus, given what I do here in Chicago, people would buy it and think it's real.
Listen, you're going to sell tickets, Paul.
Yeah,
That's the important thing in
or you'll
theater.
get, or you have to give refunds. It's one of the two.
Right.
Tego, let me come to you. I mean, you play this amazing man. I mean, James Baldwin was just an incredible, I think, larger than life figure. I already showed you my signed copy of one of his books that I have. Talk about that role and the challenges of you don't get to create. You know, you're not creating a fictional character here, and you're not even creating a real character that some of the audience will remember or not. We're actually seeing him on the screen, so you got to make it real and make it work. And you do. Talk about your preparation and a little. Tell us about James Baldwin for those who don't know.
I'm not creating a character to start with. I'm used open to saying that I was playing James Baldwin. I'm not playing James Baldwin. I am using Baldwin's words through Tegel. I have been aware of the debate for about 20 years. I came across it one night. I was watching something on Malcolm X, and I went down the rabbit hole. Next thing, I stumbled on the debate, watched it straight through, was riveted by it. My wife came home late midnight. I told her about it. We watched it again. And I decided even back then that I was going to learn that speech because it was magnificent just for the hell of it. So when Christopher approached me and asked me if I was familiar with it, I said, absolutely. I've always wanted to do it. I don't think it would be beneficial to try to impersonate him, to do him. And it's much, I make it personal because Tegel uses James Baldwin's words. You will see bits of Baldwin. You will hear line readings from Baldwin in there that I will do. So and that's clear. But that's how I approached it. I didn't, and it wasn't intimidating in that it was an honor because I got to say these words, but I've not felt intimidated at doing it at all. I want to share this quick story though. There was a gentleman in London one night. One of the most famous lines in it is when Baldwin says, "I picked the cotton, I carried it to the market, I built the railroad." And on that night, I said, "I picked the cotton, I carried it to the rail," and I used verbs instead of the pronoun. He raised his hand at the talk back and he said, "I really enjoyed this show, but I just have one question for Baldwin. Why didn't you do it like he does it on the broadcast? You didn't do it. He says, I picked it." And I explained to him basically what I'm saying to you, that what I actually told him, I said, "If you come back tomorrow night, I might do it that way." Because what I use the text as an anchor, the way a jazz musician would use the melody. And the intention is always the same, but how I go about it is different.
Oh, that's incredible. So I've got to, before I get to you, Eric, I've got to pop back to Christopher. So when this idea started, you reached out to Tegel and other, was that the plan? Was like, hey, I want you to be Tegel, or was your original plan, we're going to recreate Baldwin and Buckley?
No, the original plan was to just use the words of Baldwin and Buckley in the voice of contemporary artists because the words are still relevant. And you can't step into the shoes of Baldwin or William F. Buckley Jr. And so we are using their words to have a conversation about where we are today. And that was a conscious choice. That doesn't mean that mannerisms and cadences don't occasionally come in, as Tegel mentioned. You know, it is a piece of jazz, and it's different every night. In part because, you know, it's Tegel and Eric on stage. And before you transition to Eric, I think it's a bit of a heavier lift for Eric because, you know, just of Buckley's words, they don't resonate the same way that that Baldwin's do.
That's exactly how I wanted to approach
Yeah.
Eric, was to say, you know, I mean, you can see Tegel. Obviously, I'm guessing there was a pre-love of James Baldwin prior to all of this, and you make it yours,
Yes.
Eric. Maybe there was a pre-love of William F. Buckley for you. I don't know, but clearly, you know, at least in certain audiences in Chicago, New York, maybe other locations might play better in Oklahoma. I don't know, but my guess is you know that Buckley and the audience will see you as Buckley. I mean, I don't think we're sophisticated enough to go, it's Eric playing Buckley. You tell us that in the talk back, but talk about, you know, connecting into Eric Miller and about that. Sorry, into William Buckley and about that challenge. And I assume you too are Eric delivering the words.
Yes, I have because of Buckley. So I knew about Baldwin's part of the debate. I did not realize that it was part of a debate. I just knew that speech. And then Christopher reached out. We'd worked on something previously and said, "Hey, you want to come in and read this with my friend Tegel and just see what this is?" And I didn't know much about Buckley other than firing line Buckley, and I knew about the Vidal debate, and that was about the extent of my knowledge of him, and that he was the father of modern conservatism in the States. And I went in, and as soon as I read, when I was able to decipher what he was saying, I realized how vile it was, some of the things that were coming out of his mouth. And I realized right away that my job in this piece was to antagonize and to, I, when I go to the audience and I bring some of these words to them, I want to see anger. I want them to feel somewhat galvanized by it, to know that this man was given this platform to say so many false equivalencies and just things that you know, to not even talk about the motion at hand, to kind of just skirt around it like we do in a lot of our political discourse today. And so it's been difficult because I don't agree with any. The only thing that I agree with that Buckley says is that there's no instant cure for the race problem. So that moment I can always kind of tap into Eric there. But the rest of it, I had to find a way to activate it and find the argument and try to make it as best as I could, but also knowing, as Buckley did, or he claims that he knew going in there, he was a sacrificial lamb and they wanted to just whip the Americans for their treatment. So he went in with this kind of dripping condescension that I try to bring in as well. But I love seeing how angry the audience gets at me because it means that we're doing our job and we're getting under their skin, which is what I want.
Yeah, and I'm sure you all know this, but Christopher, of course, you are literally, as we speak now, just days away from the actual 50th anniversary that this event took place. It was February 18th, 1965.
60th.
Sorry? Oh, is my
60th.
math wrong? 60? Oh, I'm even older. All right. So I was trying to make myself a little younger. But yes, the actual February 18th, 1965, that I have right, at Cambridge Union. By the way, I think you two guys actually did the Cambridge Union presentation, right? So let me just. Tegel, was that different for you? It's one thing to do it to Paul when you were in that environment. Did that have any special impact on you and Eric's life?
Yeah, it did. It was thrilling. And before we got to perform there, we went to visit in April, I believe, because the president of the union came to see us do the show in London. And he invited us to come up to Cambridge for a tour of the place. So we thought at that time that was going to be it. You know, we got to go into the Cambridge Union. A gentleman gave us a tour. He gave us some background on it. As a matter of fact, we had lunch. When we were getting ready to leave, I told my cohorts that I had to go to the bathroom and I'd meet them outside. That was a lie. I actually went back into the Cambridge Union because I wanted to be there by myself and say the first paragraph of that speech, which I did. So I went back in and I did the first paragraph to the empty house, thinking goodbye Cambridge forever. But that wasn't the case, because we got to go back later that year. We got to go back in the fall to do two nights, and it was just thrilling. And as a matter of fact, five people who attended our first night were at the original debate in 65.
What, did they take place, take part in the talkback?
They did, intermittently, yes, they did.
And I mean,
Peter,
Eric, are you upset that you didn't think of doing what Tegel did? Go back.
I'm not because I got to go back and do it anyway. Yeah, I got to do the whole speech eventually. But it was funny because I thought that that might have been what Tegel was doing when he told us to go outside after lunch. It took him a minute, and I thought, oh, that's smart. I should have done that too. But luckily, I had the chance to go back and do it. And yeah, I echo everything Tegel said. I mean, it was an absolute thrill to be up there. You know, the lectern's the same, the benches are all the same, and the energy in the room is unlike any other place we've done it. So yeah, it was a real thrill.
Christopher, in the decision to be performing this now, part of it is just the nature of the beast. You began in 2020, and here we are. So it is what it is. But at the same time, and the night that I saw the show, the way the issues resonate, and I think we'll need you all to talk a little bit about the issues that are being raised by this presentation. But, you know, you make it clear from the very first moments that this was an event 60 years ago from 1965. I was alive, but just a little kid. And so I don't have any memory of this. But out of curiosity, how is this a project you could have done during the Obama days or something like that? Does this need to be happening now?
Well, I mean, it needs to happen now because it is happening now. And this material was relevant 40 years ago, 50 years ago, and now, you know, 60 years on. And I believe it will always be relevant as, you know, America strives to reach a higher set of ideals. You know, the question that is fundamental to the debate is, can the American dream be achieved without it being at the expense of, in this case of the debate, of the American Negro, is the terminology that's used in the debate from 1965. That question is still relevant today, and it will be relevant, you know, years from now as well. And so it feels imperative to be performing this now in, you know, a city like Chicago.
The night that I was there, the audience members who were part of the talkback, I actually had some questions I wanted to ask, but I didn't, but I am now. But people were so into it, and a lot of people just want to kind of speechify a little bit and let you know how they felt about things, and you all take that in very well. Here's one of the questions I wanted to ask you all that night. I would have actually asked it of Christopher as well, but, you know, in my question about what if this had been years ago, but let me turn it a little bit. What if Kamala Harris had won the election? Would this resonate with audiences today the way that it is now, Tegel?
I think it would resonate in a different way. I don't think the talkbacks would carry the same energy they carry now because of the way the election ended. One of the things that's been disappointing is we've played basically to all liberal houses in New York, in London, Cambridge. Even when we went to the South, we went to Tennessee, but we went to university. When we went to South Carolina, we were in an arts festival. And I'd be curious. So we get a lot of people who are more or less on the same page. And it would be interesting to hear dialogue going across that. And we've not had a lot of that.
We experienced some of that when we were in London. My experience in London in those conversations were, this is a uniquely American problem. And then inevitably somebody of color in the audience would say, no, it's not. It's a problem here in the UK as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to give you an example from my life as to why I believe that to be true. And then a conversation would unfold. So it's slightly different in that regard, because it's the idea that it is not relevant to the UK when clearly it was, which is why it resonated there so strongly.
Yeah, I think it's very different to what you're talking about in terms of London. I don't think we've had that in the United States.
I agree.
I think it's in London. That to me is very different from what from the United States. It's not.
And so let me give Eric the hypothetical on that. Eric, suppose because I don't know your tour schedule or where, but let's put you in a place where the audience is more favorable to Buckley than to Baldwin. And then you started getting those kinds of comments in the talk back afterwards. As an actor, I mean, you're playing the Buckley role. From what you say, it sounds like you don't exactly align with Buckley's views. So how would you handle that? So if those comments are being made, but they're speaking to you, they're thinking you're Buckley. I mean, we give audiences credit, but don't give them that much credit. They're going to speak to you as though you said it, you believe it. How would you address them back?
I would be very curious, because I've had to dissect Buckley's argument so much. I would want to have a conversation with them afterwards to find out what parts of Buckley's argument resonated with them. And I would hopefully want to see their point of view, but also challenge some of the arguments that are made, because they're not made in good faith. You know, there are many, many, like I said, there are straw man arguments that he makes. There are false equivalencies that he makes. At one point, he talks about one of the main problems is that using the language of 1965, that the Negro community has not made certain exertions that were made by other minorities during the American experience. And why can't they be like the other good minorities? And that's a false equivalency, because when you're talking about a minority that came here by choice with their family, with their customs, had a community, that's one immigration experience, which is very different than the African-American immigration experience, which was chained and brought here against your will, without your family, without your people. You weren't given rights. Those are very, very different experiences. And to try to compare the two and say, why can't you just do it as well as this good minority did, is, again, it's not making the argument in good faith, because you're leaving out you're leaving out history, you're leaving out facts. And so I would love to hear what they had to say and what resonated with them. And I would like to unpack it with them and perhaps show them that, you know, there's another way at looking at some of the data that he introduces in this argument.
Going along with what Eric's saying, I've thought so many times this can never happen now. I'd be curious to hear from the 164 people who voted for Buckley that night. The vote was 544 to 164, I believe. And it would have been really interesting to hear the 164. I think I encountered one in London.
I was just going to say, yeah, we had a guy, to your point, Paul, people not feeling comfortable perhaps talking about it afterwards because they know that they're in a room with people right. that are on Baldwin's side. Right. We had a gentleman in London who said, oh, I was there at the debate. And Christopher said, oh, would you like to share who you voted for? And he went. And then we moved right along. It was like, okay, enough said.
And therein we had our answer.
Exactly.
I will also say.
It would have been interesting to hear why, though. I mean,
yeah.
Well, with some fear to talk about it. Christopher?
Yeah, I will say, Paul, the first time we performed this in front of a live audience was at the Women's National Republican Club in New York City.
Ah. My only home game, Paul, my only home game.
Yeah. And that was the conversation afterwards was really interesting. And we sat down and we broke bread. And, there was a beautiful moment that, Tegel, if you want to share, when you were leaving the building.
Yeah, and I'm glad you bring that up, because this came up the other evening in a talk back, and I brought up, we were talking about how we were playing to, if you will, liberal audiences. That night, we played to the Women's National Republican Club, and I was leaving the theater. We had dinner with them after, and clearly a room of conservatives, and two ladies approached me, and one was very complimentary about the evening and the performances, and she said, you made me, I heard things I'd never heard before from Baldwin, and you made me think about things in a different way, and that was gratifying.
Wow.
Doesn't mean she's going to wake up the next morning and change her political party or whatever, but that's all I want is just...
Yeah, opening your mind. By the way, Eric, when I think of Buckley from back in the day, I mean, as conservative as they are, whatever, but if he were, I won't load this question. Is there anybody on the conservative circuit today who Buckley would be? I guess what I'm saying is, I don't think Buckley would say, go Tucker Carlson. I don't think that's who he was.
I've wondered about this a lot. And people often ask us those questions, and I can't speak as to what Buckley would think or feel today. I never met the man, but I will tell you that I recently was rereading God and Man at Yale, his kind of coming out party book that he wrote while he was at Yale. And he's got a new foreword in there that he wrote in 51, I think. And he says in it, at a sentence, he says, and the modern conservative, parentheses, and don't even get me started on the modern conservative. And I think to myself when I read that, oh, Billy, if you had a problem with him in 1951, I'd hate to show it to him in 2025, because I think. But someone said the other day, actually, a lot of people bring up, if this was today, who would it be? And a name that we often hear for Baldwin is Ta-Nehisi Coates. And someone said the other day, they said Stephen Miller for Buckley. And people usually go to Tucker Carlson. That's the first time I've heard someone say Stephen Miller. And I do think that the level of dangerous rhetoric that Stephen Miller uses certainly echoes of some of Buckley's.
I think there is accuracy there. Yeah, because Tucker Carlson, some of these are so sort of media out there, and Stephen Miller is living the work.
Exactly.
Really good.
So yeah, I thought that was a good comparison by that audience member.
Yeah, Christopher, we're referencing all these talkbacks, and for folks who are watching us or listening and haven't seen the show, you know, oftentimes talkbacks, Timeline, and others, there's certain nights that you say, come this night if you want to have a talkback. But clearly a talkback is a critical portion of this show, and it happens every night.
Yeah, we don't really call it a talkback. It's more of a conversation,
keeping
in the Cambridge style of debate, where anybody who's present in the chamber is allowed to express their thoughts on what they heard tonight. And so we try to frame that conversation in terms of relevancy, and if this material is still relevant 60 years later, and if so, why, and how is it related to our current public discourse? And so, you know, we just kind of pose that idea and then allow audience to respond however they would like to respond, without, you know, seeking to control language or outcomes, and just an organic conversation that unfolds. And sometimes it becomes a little bit of an echo chamber in terms of, you know, liberal progressive things, and other times there's a beautiful exchange of ideas where two people express different views, but ultimately do so with you know, civility.
Yeah. And before, we're almost out of time, sadly, but I could go on for an hour with you guys. Not that you want to, but I would. But Christopher, also, the show does open with two, I would say, students, younger people, two students who also present a Buckley and a Baldwin argument. Do you do that because that's the way it was? Do you do that because you're at DePaul and you also want to involve? I mean, is it a critical part of this? Does that happen wherever you are and wherever this is done?
Yes. Yeah. So we do include the introductions from David Haycock and Jeremy Burford. We met Mr. Haycock when we were performing in London. He came to see the show. And it's part of the Cambridge style of debate. The motion is first argued by students from college, and then it moves on to the main speakers. And so it was important for us to keep that.
And those are DePaul acting students who get to do
that?
Yes,
we have four DePaul acting students, and they rotate do different nights. So
gotcha.
Aspen, Alex, Quentin, and Jack.
Yeah, just great. And of course, they have the same challenge as you, Tegel and Eric, which is, do I want to be those guys? Do I want to present, you know, these views? But these are performances that you're doing. And it's so important to understand that. I love the fact that you're saying, I'm doing these words. This is Tegel, you know, presenting Baldwin's words, and Eric, I'm presenting words I don't necessarily agree with, but these were the words that got said. So powerful. I wish we had more time, and you're so wonderful to talk to all of you, but I don't want to get cut off without telling people that they have through March 2nd to see the show. There will be no extension. I've asked, I'm trying to get it, but not happening. Debate Baldwin versus Buckley, a real event. In fact, I went with my partner who said, I want to watch the real one, and went home and watched that. TimelineTheater.com, theater spelled the proper British way, T-R-E. I do want to add that in, to get your tickets only through March 2nd. And it's at Cordell U Commons at DePaul University, one of DePaul's interests. And what a great environment to do this one in. It's like being in London. Thanks to all of you for joining me. Break legs on the rest of your run. I wish you had a longer run, but thank you. I appreciate your time talking to me.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
Yes.